and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and at your convenience on voiceofvashon.org. I'm calling today's episode my grand finale of 4 weeks covering how politics is personal, my personal run-up to the November 3rd election. I want to do anything I can to encourage you who are giving me some of your precious time to vote as if your life depends on it, because it does. And this month, I brought guests to Real Talk who can illustrate the impact of politics and the resulting government on your life every day. So today, I'm joined by a man who works exhaustively in the interest of justice. He is Kendrick Washington, Youth Policy Counsel for Washington State's ACLU. Welcome, Kendrick.
Thank you, Susan. Appreciate being here.
It's really a delight to have you, and I'm counting on you for a lot today. So I'm going to start with a quote that I found that struck me as the crux of what you and your colleagues at the American Civil Liberties Union aim for every day. Here's that quote: "Justice is what love looks like in public." How do you respond to that?
You know, it's funny. I was reading that quote the other day. It's one I've read for a lot of years. I respond to that by saying I think that's exactly true. Like, justice and integrity and honor isn't what we do behind closed doors when no one's watching, although that is important too. But it's all of those things in a public-facing manner. It's not just saying you care, but showing you care publicly, making sure that there's equity for people publicly, and making sure that you express that love and respect for people in a public manner, much in the same way we tear people down these days in a public manner. If you're going to have one, you've got to have the other. So I think that's how I respond to that.
Ooh, I like that. So what do you see as the current political issues most likely to affect the most human beings in our country?
Wow. I mean, that's tough, you know, and it's hard to want to speak for the entire country, but I think that Washington, often cast as a liberal state, really is a place of diverse political views. And I think what's true here is true, nationwide. And so I think there are a lot of things at stake. I think COVID disparities are at stake. You know, the people you're going to vote for on a federal level are going to be making decisions about funding for public health and for COVID relief, and that's going to impact the states we live in. There have been racial disparities in the illness and death rates for COVID-19 in Washington and across the country as well, and so that's going to impact a great number of people. And then I think perhaps the other biggest issue is sort of how are we going to reimagine public safety, right? Like, we've heard a lot about defund and divest and reinvest. But whatever phrasing you're using, we're all thinking about what public safety is going to look like. And so, again, who you vote for in federal and state and local government will determine the environment in which our local communities are going to fight for a reimagining of public safety that truly serves everyone. And then, of course, who you vote for also determines the funding and policies that are made available to traditional police, the war on drugs, and then the alternatives to those things.
And, of course, we just witnessed Amy Coney Barrett being confirmed to the Supreme Court, making it a 6-3 conservative court. And you mentioned COVID-19, I think coming up before the Supreme Court within the next week is the Affordable Care Act, which conservatives want to eliminate. How do you see her confirmation and her appointment to the Supreme Court affecting things like the Affordable Care Act, like criminal justice?
You know, I don't want to speculate on what the justice is going to do. She's the justice now. She's no longer the nominee. I don't want to speculate on what she's going to do, because honestly, she wouldn't answer those questions very candidly during the process. You know, she said she was going to take each case by case. And so, you know, I think, you know, hopefully I hope she's going to actually be true to her word. I think that in the past, we've seen that even though a justice is viewed as conservative or liberal, depending on the case, how they vote actually does align with the law. We've seen that several times with Justice Roberts. We've even seen that a number of times now with Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh, where we thought they would go one way because they were quote-unquote conservative, but actually their understanding of the law led them down a different path.
Well, that's encouraging and hopeful. How much do you think, as we're talking about this, the opinion of voters or of people actually influences the Supreme Court or justices thereon?
You know, I don't know that the opinions of voters matter a great deal in the day-to-day operations of the court. I think we've seen that, you know, a bunch of times. That, you know, what the majority of the American public wants and what a Supreme Court justice views as their interpretation of the Constitution don't always align. However, there are times, and there have been cases, where the justice says, where the court says, you know what, the overwhelming public view on what is moral or what is cruel has shifted, right? And mm-hmm. So, you know, we see that now. So, for instance, we saw that with the not using the death penalty on juveniles a little over a decade ago, right? What the court basically said was that the public attitude towards this has shifted, and the public now does see this as cruel and unusual, and the morality, how we view that from a moral standpoint. And so I think from that standpoint, the court can be swayed by public opinion if they see that the majority of the public sees something as a moral issue and as an issue of cruelty or unjustness, and they can be swayed in that regard. But the average day-to-day vote of the public, I don't think, has much impact.
Well, that's interesting. How possible, then, do you think it will be for Democrats, should they win the White House and the Senate, to add justices to the Supreme Court?
I mean, it's possible. You know, I don't want to speculate. I know there's been a lot of talk about court packing, and people have opinions about that, right or wrong. Is it possible? Yes. Will it happen? I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of things that I think have to go into play. I mean, one, we have to win the White House, and we have to win the Senate.
Yes.
And then, you know, you would have to see that win happen by, you know, a large enough number that something like that can be done, because not every Democrat is for that, not every liberal is for that, not every conservative is opposed. So it's a really tough, tricky area that it's really hard to speculate about.
Okay, let's go to an area that may not require quite so much speculation on your part, but then again, maybe it will. Beyond the presidential race, what down-ballot elections do you see as important to turning our government more in the direction of helping the majority?
Well, sure. So, I mean, down-ballot voting really matters, right? It's not just whose name is at the top of the ticket. You know, races at every level of government are crucial to promoting justice. So here in Washington, you know, because this is where, you know, we're currently living, you know, there are a couple of down ballot things that really matter. For instance, the referendum 90, related, you know, the one that the law requires all public schools to teach age appropriate, inclusive, comprehensive, sex education to K-12. Like, that's a huge issue. That I think maybe hasn't gotten quite a lot of attention, but it's going to change the landscape, I think, for Washington students in a number of important ways.
Yeah, that's an interesting issue. What do you see as the opposition, and how would you respond to that?
I mean, the opposition is really a group of folks who sort of in 2020 really launched a misinformation campaign attacking inclusive, age-appropriate, health, comprehensive sex education. And I think my response to that is it was a small group of people who had a very passionate view, but they were extremely well-organized, they were extremely well-funded, and they pushed a campaign that really, really grossly misinforms a lot of people, and I think that's how they built support. And the misinformation, I mean, it's not just wrong, but it's actually dangerous and harmful to Washington youth, and it's hard to imagine a parent who actually understood what the truth of those issues are wanting to do away with this.
So what exactly was that opposition? What was the misinformation that was being disseminated?
Well, sure. You know, and I don't want to sort of regurgitate, you know, bad information, but there was a lot of information about what the curriculum was going to be teaching, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the R90 curriculum is actually age appropriate, and the concern came around kindergarten through third grade. You know, there were people who thought it was going to be teaching kindergartners how to have sex. And I mean, it's right. I mean, I hear you sort of laugh.
Really?
It's so ridiculous on right. its face that it's hard to want to take serious, but here we are because they promulgated this information. But the curricula is age appropriate, right? So, for example, the K through third grade curriculum is focused on social emotional learning standards, which teach young students to protect themselves from sexual abuse. It teaches them personal boundaries. It teaches them human development. It teaches them how to identify and talk to a trusted adult. Now, this is the key, right? The how mm-hmm. to talk to a trusted adult. Because at that young age, kids don't know how to explain what's happening to them. And by teaching them this, what you're actually preventing is you're actually preventing sexual abuse. That
yes.
is what you're preventing. You're keeping kids from keeping secrets from adults, from allowing abuse to happen to them. Now, if you walked up to any parent and said, I can teach your kids things that will either ensure they won't be sexually abused or that the second it happens, they're going to come to you and talk to you or talk to someone so we can stop that and keep it from becoming a larger problem, what rightful parent would say, nah, that's okay.
Right.
I don't want that.
Right.
No one. But yet, the opposition to this is promoting that they're going to be teaching kids lewd and lascivious sorts of things. And I wish I had a fancier word for it than nonsense, but it doesn't deserve a word fancier than that because that is precisely what it is. It's absolute. It's a lie. It's not the truth. It's sheer propaganda.
I think I would actually add perverse to that because it displays a tremendous misunderstanding of gender and sexuality and just plain fear, paranoia.
Right. It is perverse because you had to look at everything that R90 was about. You had to read this information, assuming they read, and then say, I don't like this, but I'm going to make up a complete and utter lie to do away with this thing that I don't like. Instead of arguing it on the merits of what it actually is, you said, I'm going to make up a lie and then tell this lie to other people who I know aren't going to read but are just going to follow behind the lies I'm telling, and that's how I'm going to get rid of this thing. And that's sort of precisely what it was.
And, you know, I think that might be a strategy that other groups are using on other issues that you at the ACLU are addressing. Could you mention a couple of those issues, especially those involved with criminal justice and drug, I guess it would be drug convictions?
I think there are sort of a lot of these things out there. And I think one of the things we want people to understand is, because this again comes back to sort of what do we understand about safety and what is actually making the community safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things around drug use and drug addiction is that people are automatically told, oh, if there are drugs, there's crime. And that's actually not always the case. Yes, in some places there are crimes that are affiliated with drug use, but the average person who is addicted to a drug is a person who has an illness. This isn't a person that is a criminal that's out there seeking to do harm. And so I think one of the key things we have to understand is that substance use disorders are a public health issue, not a crime issue, right? And that's where the sort of separation of, you know, what should we do with people who are addicted to drugs? That's where you sort of see the opposition. Some people want to treat it as crime. Others want to treat it as a public health disorder. And without recognizing that by treating drug addiction as a crime, you are actually ruining an individual's life and maybe even possibly continuing their spiral instead of actually providing them with the help and opportunity they need. You know, drug possession arrest can actually ruin someone's life. But also, taking the criminal justice approach is costly. It costs about $112 a day to incarcerate a person. I'm not super great at math, but if you multiply 365 days times $112, that's not an insignificant amount of money. And the reality is, treatment costs less money. So we're talking about, so now we've got two things. We're talking about being able to help a person on the one hand and provide them with the treatment that they need so they can go forward and live a productive life. And we're talking about, on the other hand, being able to save money. And in the times that we're in, when the budget is where it is, being able to save money is a massive thing.
Well, on that subject, are there any issues currently on the ballot in Washington State that might begin to address the need to either begin treating drug addiction as a health issue or reducing sentences for those folks who've been convicted of drug, quote, crimes?
So I don't know that there's anything on the ballot related to criminal justice at the moment. There are going to be some measures that are going to be pushed forward this upcoming legislative session, giving, you know, legislators the opportunity to really change the laws around incarceration. And of course, then there's also the, you know, treatment first Washington. And that's really been an ongoing push in Washington to pass the treatment and, you know, the Treatment First Washington campaign to pass the Treatment and Recovery Act, which really works to decriminalize drug possession and drug use, and, you know, again, as I stated before, treated as a public health issue. Our war on drugs approach has not addressed our growing substance use disorder crisis, and in fact, it's really made it worse. And I think over the last decade or so, you know, folks have come to understand that. And I think the other key too that people need to understand is that decriminalization is not the same as legalization, right? So you're not going to be able to run to your corner store and buy meth or PCP or just, you know, I don't know what they call it, an 8-ball of cocaine. You know, you're not going to be able to just run to the 7-Eleven and pick up some crack on a whim, right? What decrim is saying is we're taking something that is harmful, and instead of making it a crime, we're seeing it as a health concern, and we're going to change that.
And we've done that with nicotine.
Right, we've done that with nicotine. We've done that with marijuana.
Right.
You know, we went back and forth in this country with alcohol, you know, during Prohibition and then afterwards, and then what age was appropriate for people to use alcoholic substances. And, you know, time and time again, studies have shown that alcoholic substances and people's addiction to alcohol have actually caused far greater crime than drugs. But yet here we are, alcohol completely legal, and yet for some reason folks are afraid to take drug issues and treat that as a crime. And I think we have to understand that, like, addiction really is a disease. It's not simply just a matter of will or control, and that individuals who do have drug addictions, they need help.
Well, and I'm trying to remember the name of the family that has recently been sued, if you will, for the opioid crisis. I'm wondering if the extent of the opioid crisis might move people toward the notion that it really is a health issue, because so many more Americans are touched personally by the opioid crisis. How do you view that? Is that a potential help toward decriminalizing drugs?
Sure. I think the opioid crisis has really brought it to mainstream America, right? Like, for a while, the image that was pushed about drugs is this was an inner city problem. This was a lower income problem.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a Black American and or minority problem. And what we've seen through the prescription of, you know, opioids and then the addiction that follows for those folks when they can't get their prescribed opioids, we've seen this hit really sort of America everywhere, right? It's hit the heartland, it's hit the big cities, it's hit rural communities, and quite frankly, it's hit white communities,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the white majority has suddenly seen what the rest of the country has been facing. They're like, oh, this is actually a problem. Drugs, you know, I think when you know someone who's been addicted to drugs, someone that you love and someone that you care about, someone that you sort of held up in esteem, you know, men with businesses and families and great jobs who've lost it all to an opioid addiction, you begin to realize what I was saying before, like, this isn't a matter of someone who's weak-willed or doesn't want to change or doesn't have anything that they care about. Like, addiction impacts people regardless of their race, regardless of their socioeconomic status, regardless of where they live in this country. And I think the opioid crisis has really brought it home to Americans that we need a change in how we deal with drug policy and that it's not a war on drugs. We don't want to wage war on our neighbors. We don't want to wage war on our brothers and sisters and family members.
Well, and
you would never wage war. You want to treat and care for these folks and provide and nurture them and provide them everything they need. And I think the opioid crisis has sort of opened folks' eyes to that.
Well, and I hope that might begin to affect legislation. But, you know, that brings me to an issue that is much broader. And I think things like the war on drugs and the criminalization of drug addiction and so forth are just part of our living under minority rule at this point, meaning that the people who are making our laws are not in sync with the majority of Americans who do have personal issues regarding drugs, drug addiction, and other issues. What do we need to do to change that minority rule?
You know, I don't know if minority rule is the word for it anymore, because, like I said, it is so far spread, it is so widespread. But I think we need to get back to a place where facts actually are the way we make our decisions, where we once again rely on science and we say, okay, this is what the science says, and try to help Americans get back to a place where we can accept, hey, what we thought about this particular thing either was not true or at least is no longer true. And now that this thing is no longer true, we need to change our views on this and what we're willing to do. And I think that we've got 20, 30, heck, almost 40 years, really, even longer than that, going back to the Nixon administration, of evidence that a war on drugs has not been a helpful approach, that drug addiction has spiraled, it has increased. It's been during good economies, it's been during bad economies, it's been in minority communities, it's been in majority communities. And I think that at some point, Americans just have to realize that if we want to create a change, if we want to be able to emulate, you know, the other great places around the world that aren't struggling with drug addiction, that we're going to have to change our approach. Like, we can't keep trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. At some point, you grow frustrated and you try a different approach.
Well, and I think a similar view could be applied to issues like general health care, like the climate crisis. It brings me to the notion of given that the Democrats won the popular vote in at least three of the last presidential elections and Republicans still won the presidency with electoral votes, would you please explain to our listeners how the popular vote can truly overwhelm the Electoral College in this election? How big does the popular vote have to be?
You know, I think really what this election is going to boil down to is turnout, right? I think you have a lot of states that have been gerrymandered, particularly in their local politics. to the point where even if a majority of the people feel a certain way, their voices aren't being truly represented. I think the popular vote doesn't necessarily have to be more significant than it was. I think the popular vote has to be more significant than it was in 2016. Mm. But I think really it's going to be more about where that popular vote turns out, right? Where is that drive? I think a lot of people who live in blue states or who live in red states or states that we now consider purple think to themselves, well, this is in the bag, or they see the polls. And what they don't appreciate about the polls is the polls are not actual votes that are cast, right? The polls are projections and questions asked of registered voters.
Right.
But on the day of the election, or in this case, in the weeks before the election, because so much is being done with mail-in balloting now, it's really incumbent upon the registered voters, well, one, for folks to get registered, but then two, not to just be registered, but to actually find a way to get out there and vote, whether it's your mail-in ballot, whether it's standing in line, you know, on election day, taking advantage of early elections. And I think you've really seen a change in the turnout. I saw something just yesterday where I think in 2016 they said by this time about 47,000 Florida voters had voted either in early election or mail-in ballot. This year there's 270,000 Floridians who've turned out early to vote.
Wow,
again,
I need my
really,
applause.
Not really great at math,
yeah,
but
that's a
pretty significant increase, you know, from, you know, in 2019 compared to 2020 compared to 2016.
Kendrick Washington of Washington's American Civil Liberties Union, we're almost out of time. This has been such a fascinating conversation with you, and I so appreciate your time. One last question. How would you rate the health of our democracy today?
Man, I would rate that. That's a tough one. I would rate the health of our democracy as unhealthy, maybe not on life support, but definitely checked in and in need of treatment. I still, and I think the rest of the ACLU still believes greatly in our democratic process. I understand that there are flaws that people see in both, you know, the Electoral College versus the popular vote, and even, you know, the way we, you know, populate our courts and our system. But I think that our democracy is such, and our Constitution was written in a way as such, that these are all things that are actually still within our power to fix, and that we can actually still do these things through the ballot box. So while I think our democracy has been threatened and I think it has been challenged, I still think that it's strong and that a recovery can be made. And it's going to start, you know, hopefully right here in 2020 with everyone who believes in the American dream on some level getting out there to the ballot box and casting their lot and hoping to build a better future.
Kendrick Washington, I want to thank you for that hopeful close. And I want to invite you to return to Real Talk soon and tell us about the ACLU's role, dependent on who wins the election. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, we'll definitely get someone.
Yeah. Thanks again, Kendrick.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe here with you every Tuesday, and delighted that you're willing to share some of your precious time with me.